Welcome to the Subcommittee on Integration Aid. So today is the first hearing of the Integration Aid Subcommittee, and it's a small group, so we'll start by letting the members who are here introduce themselves, and then I will also address who is on the subcommittee who's not here. But I can tell you, as the chair of the subcommittee, I'm Senator Terry Bonoff, that we are very excited to begin this process, that this has been a long time in coming. We actually are going to begin with the legislative auditor's report, and as most people are aware, the legislative audit was done a few years back, and yet we still have not taken a significant stab at policy reform. And that is really our goal, is to begin this subcommittee with an understanding of what has gone on in the past, to look at it from the broadest perspective of what should integration aid be about in today's terms and in our future terms. And so today will be an introduction and an overview, and then I look forward to a frank dialogue with the members of the subcommittee so that we come up with and craft the very best policy going forward. In terms of a timeline, if people are wondering, are we going to come out with a bill this session? I think that's pretty aggressive given where we are in the calendar. So it would surprise me if we came forward with a bill, but I'm open to being surprised. I would more suspect that because this is a very complex and complicated issue, that it'll take some work over the interim as well. So with that, I'll now allow the members to introduce themselves.
Oh, thank you, Senator Bonhoff. I'm David Hand, representing Eden Prairie and part of Minnetonka, just south of Senator Bonhoff's district. Served on a school board for 8 years before being elected to the legislature in 2002. And I appreciate, Madam Chairman, your interest in this issue and your willingness to chair this committee. This has been a longstanding, I think, challenge, and many of us have talked about this informally and in committee that we should really take a hard look at this. So I appreciate your proactivity in doing this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Phoebe, and I'm from the Princeton area, brand new on the Senate. This is actually my first subcommittee, so I really appreciate being invited to be on this. I was on the Princeton School Board for 8 years. I represent 11 school districts, more in greater Minnesota, and I also was on the Minnesota School Board Association, so I'm very interested in this issue and honored to serve on this subcommittee. Thank you.
Thank you. And to my right will be Senator Claire Roebling. And Senator Claire Roebling has served on the Education Committee for many years and so brings both a historical perspective and I know some pretty strong ideas about the way we ought to approach integration aid in the future. And so I'm pleased that she is on this working subcommittee. And then the other person who is not here as of yet, who will be joining us later today, is Senator Torres Ray. Senator Torres Ray, representing Minneapolis, brings a different perspective to the conversation. So I think you will see that we each bringing forward different constituencies will allow for a rich and varied conversation. So as far as today's agenda, we'll begin with the Legislative Auditor's Office, Judy Randall, and then we'll ask Morgan Brown to come and speak from the Department of Education's perspective, and then we're going to ask Tom Gillespie, who's our state demographer, to share some of his thoughts about the direction our demographics are moving as we look down the road. So with that, I'll begin with Ms. Randall. And before Ms. Randall begins, I would also like to introduce John Eichten, who's my legislative assistant, and he will be staffing the subcommittee. And so if there's anything you need, please contact him. Looks like. Do you need anything else, Ms. Randall? We can get you some technical assistance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know what I'll do is I'll just start talking. See how long it takes, and we'll go from there. But I believe you have a handout. So I'll start with that, and hopefully I won't get too distracted by entering in passwords. It's just a matter of booting up. So I'm good, thanks. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I'm happy to be here today to talk about our school district integration revenue evaluation. As the chair referenced, we released this report in 2005, in the fall of 2005. And so what I've done is I've done my best to update some of the numbers, particularly the participation numbers and the financial numbers. But some of the demographic information in here is a little out of date, but I think that the bigger point of the findings and our recommendations still hold. So we'll just, if you'll just bear with me as the computer boots up, the first slide here, or slide number two on your handout, outlines kind of our major findings. And in general, we found that the program needs more focus and more oversight. First, we found that the purpose of the program is not clear. And in part because of that, we found that school districts use the integration revenue in a variety of ways, mostly consistent with what they view the purpose of the program to be, and in many ways reasonable, but we did find some questionable uses of the funding, which I'll get into. And then we also found that the funding formula has some unintended consequences, what we found to be unintended consequences, and I'll talk about that in further detail as well. I'm moving on to the next slide, and again, I'm going to just try and keep this computer going, so hold on a sec. Sorry about this.
I think it's coming up, Ms. Randolph.
Yeah, it's going. Okay, so the next slide is regarding just the participation right now. In 2009, so in the current school year, there are 116 school districts that are participating in the program, and excuse me as I just do this password, and collectively they receive $87 million. And one thing that's notable is that this is a pretty big increase from when we did this report 3 years ago. In 2005, there were 80 school districts participating in the program. So in 2005, 80 school districts participating. In 2009, according to the department numbers, 116 school districts participating. In 2005, it was about $79 million. In current years, they're estimating $87 million. So again, a pretty sizable increase, I think, in 3 years. Districts can participate. All right, let's see if I can get this going. Districts are identified as eligible under a couple of different sets of criteria, or they can voluntarily participate in the program. And it's a little complicated, so I'm going to walk through the different definitions and how it works. So the first way a district can be identified as eligible is if they have a school that is a racially identifiable school. And also, I will say I use the term identified as eligible, but really if they're identified as having a racially identifiable school, they're required to participate. So they're both eligible, but they're required to participate. They have responsibilities under that, and then they also receive revenue to help them meet those responsibilities. So a racially identifiable school is if there is a school within a school district that has a more than 20 percentage point higher protected student enrollment than the district average Let me give an example because it's jargony and I'm sure I just messed that up. So when we did our evaluation, and here we go. When we did our evaluation, Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan had an elementary school that had 43% enrollment of protected students. That was more than 20 percentage points higher than the district-wide average of 19 percentage points of protected student enrollment.
And Ms. Randall, could you define protected student?
Sure. Let me get the actual language. I believe it's defined in law, in rule. So in rule, which the rule is 3535.0110, protected student means A, students who self-identify or are identified in the general racial categories of African Black Americans, Asian Pacific Americans, Chicano Latino Americans, and American Indian Alaskan Native, and B, multiracial students who self-identify or are identified as having origins in more than one of the categories described in Item A or as having origins in one of the categories described in Item A and in the category of Caucasian. You need me to do that again?
Ms. Randall, thank you. I would ask that that we get a copy of that so that as we proceed with our work that we have that in front of us. Thank you.
Sure. All right. Okay, I'm going to try and get to where I am here now that we're online here. Okay, so a racially identifiable school. That's another thing to think about for that one is it's intra-district. So it's a school within a district that has a significantly higher concentration of protected students. That's kind of the easy, non-official way of thinking about it. If that's the case, that district is required to participate in the program, it needs to put together an integration plan and an integration budget, and then it's eligible to receive the funding. The next way to become eligible is if you're a racially isolated district, and this is now inter-district. So in this case, if it's a school district, if a school district has a significantly higher percentage of protected students than its immediately neighboring districts, then that racially isolated district and its neighboring, also called adjoining districts, are eligible for the program. They must work together across district lines, collaborate, come together with an integration plan, an integration budget, and then they work together. It's complicated, so we put together this just to help see it graphically or visually. So St. Paul is here in my example, and these are demographic data from 2005, but the point still holds. So St. Paul's there in red. That's the isolated district. You can see it has more than 20 percentage point above in terms of protected student enrollment of its neighboring districts. So those yellow districts are the adjoining neighboring districts. So you can see St. Paul at 72% has a significantly higher protected student population than, let's say, Roseville at 26%, North St. Paul at 25%, South Washington County, South St. Paul, and West St. Paul. So under integration revenue, St. Paul, the isolated district, and all of those yellow adjoining districts are going to work together to put together an integration plan, collaboration plan, and integration budget. Now, in addition to being identified as eligible, we need some new computers, I think. School districts can voluntarily participate in the program. So these are districts that are not identified as isolated district. They're not a neighboring district, but they're choosing to participate in the program. And if they work together with an isolated district, then they participate in the program, then they too are eligible for the revenue. And here we'll just build off this St. Paul example. You can see in the pinkish-purple districts, those are all the voluntary districts that as of 2005, we're working with St. Paul, and the department, I think, can speak. I think some of these relationships may have changed over the past year. But so there you see White Bear Lake, Matomidi, Stillwater, and Inver Grove Heights are voluntarily participating in the program and are therefore eligible for the funding as well. And this is a map. It shows you in 2005 where the school districts that participated in the program were located. Now, you can see it's really concentrated around the metro area and then in southwestern Minnesota. Again, I'll remind you that more than 30 districts have been added to this that aren't reflected in the map, but my guess is that it's still concentrated in those areas of the state.
Ms. Randall, could you remind us, when a school district participates on a voluntary basis, are they getting the same revenue on a per pupil basis as those that actually have the students that are racially protected? Sure.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. I will be getting into the funding in a little more detail, but if you're a voluntary district, you receive funding at the rate of $92 per pupil, and it's per total enrollment. So it's all of your students, $92 per all of your students. Some of the yellow districts, if you will, the adjoining districts, might also be receiving the funding at the $92 rate. They might be receiving it at $129 rate, and that will depend on their percentage of protected students.
Thank you.
Sure. I'm going to switch now from kind of the brief overview to talking more directly about our findings. As I mentioned in the beginning, one of our big findings was that the purpose of the program is not clear. And, in fact, there are lots of different ideas regarding the purpose of this program. As part of our evaluation, we visited 20 school districts across the state that were participating in the program. And, you know, we met with 20 districts, and we heard more than 20 ideas about what this program was about. So I'm going to just share some of them with you now. Increased parent involvement, to provide staff development, offer all-day kindergarten, achieve student success, and the list just goes on. There's all sorts of different ideas about what the purpose of the Integration Revenue Program is. So the point here is that there's lots of different ones, and they really vary. So what we did is we took all the different ideas we heard and we kind of boiled them down into six main categories. The first one was to achieve racial balance and integration. Kind of, I would say kind of a more traditional view of integration and integration in the classroom. The next one was to reduce the achievement gap.
The next was to provide staff development. You know, I think that went often hand in hand with the more traditional integration idea, which is if you're having students that haven't been in your classroom before of different backgrounds and different traditions, then you want your staff educated in how to work best with students from all backgrounds. To increase multicultural awareness of both students and staff. To increase community involvement in the schools. And then to increase interracial contact, which is the language in the law, is interracial contact. So you can see this is pretty broad. And frankly, what we felt was pretty much any type of expenditure, or practically any type of expenditure, can be justified under these very broad parameters of what this program is about. So not surprisingly, that led us to our next finding of the fact that districts use the revenue in a variety of ways, you know, often in line with what they think the purpose of the program is. So, for example, in the metro area in particular, we saw inter-district magnet schools. And the Northwest Suburban Integration School District is one example of this. So it's a collaboration of districts in the Northwest Metro. It includes Brooklyn Center, Robbinsdale, Osseo, Buffalo, Rockford, Fridley, others I'm not mentioning. So it's a big collaboration of districts up in the Northwest Metro. They've established magnet schools in their existing schools that are then open to all of the students within their integration district. So if I'm a student in Robbinsdale, I might choose to attend a magnet school in Buffalo, for example. And so in this way, they've used their revenue to help promote those magnet schools and develop those magnet schools. Also in the metro area, we saw some classroom partnerships. An example of this is between St. Paul and Stillwater. So they would kind of match up classrooms that would work together throughout the year on somewhat of a remote basis, but then they would also get together periodically throughout the year to work together, maybe in a retreat fashion, to work together on projects. So in both of these examples, the students were able to develop kind of ongoing, sustained, meaningful relationships with students from other school districts and possibly with, you know, different backgrounds. Outstate districts, it was harder to do these types of activities that took place during the school day simply because of, you know, distance, location, geography. So there we saw more things that took place outside of the school day, such as summer academic camps or soccer camps. Again, efforts to bring students together in ongoing and meaningful ways to develop the relationships. Also, in both outstate and metro area, we saw lots of districts using the funds for multicultural festivals. You know, I would say that's not as much of a meaningful ongoing relationship that's achieved through a multicultural festival, but it does provide the education of, you know, different traditions and different cultures and different backgrounds. Now, even within the broad parameters of integration revenue and the broad purposes that people seem to think exist under the program, we did find some uses of the revenue that we thought were questionable. In particular, we heard of a district that used the integration revenue to purchase U.S. history textbooks, and another to use the funding to provide ELL services. You know, in our view, these are existing responsibilities of all school districts. At one point, I don't think I actually emphasized, probably I was distracted by the technology, but the fact that not all school districts receive this money. I mean, so it's grown from 80 to 116 school districts, but it's still just one-third of the school districts that are receiving this money. And so with that, we think comes an added burden of using that funding for something other than what is expected of all school districts. And things like purchasing textbooks and ELL services are existing responsibilities of all school districts and not something that we think integration revenue, that's not an extra thing. We think that's kind of a supplanting. Okay, now let me talk about the funding now. I know you had a question on that. We thought the way the funding is distributed, there are some unintended consequences. Broadly, we think that the way the funding is distributed, it does not reflect school districts' different needs and challenges under this program. And also, the way it's set out in law, it results in limited oversight of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and also those voluntary pink, if you will, school districts. So let me talk about how the funding is allocated. So every district is given a funding rate that's used to calculate the amount of integration revenue. Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, their rate is outlined
Ms.
in
Randall,
law specifically. Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about why there's limited oversight in those districts that you mentioned versus other districts that
sure.
are in the program?
Sure. In the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, I'm going to be getting to that.
Okay.
But I can't. In part, it's because mean, I can give you the quick one now, and then it'll be boring later, but I'll still do that. The Department of Education has to approve the integration budgets for all school districts except Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. So Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth don't need the department's approval over their integration budget.
And Ms. Randall, what was the rationale?
Well, I can't speak to the rationale. I can speak to the way it's written out in law. Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are identified specifically in law with their funding rate and kind of given that money. And then all the other districts are given the money through the rules. Given the money and then held to the rules, which includes the approval of the integration budget. And I don't know if Mr. Brown or others from the department want to elaborate on that or if they know more than that. I don't know.
Ms. Randall, I'll have them address that when they get to that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. So here we've got the amounts in law, the funding rates in law for these three districts. It looks like Minneapolis has more than St. Paul on a funding rate, but that's not actually the case by state standards, by the way the state allocates the money. So Minneapolis and St. Paul both receive $445 per student. Minneapolis is given authority to levy an additional $35 locally. So that's how they get up to the $480 per pupil. St. Paul, $445. Duluth, $206 per pupil. All other school districts receive funding based in large part on their percentage of protected student enrollment. So an isolated school district, a red school district, in our example it was St. Paul, receives either $92 or $129 per pupil, depending on its protected student enrollment. If it has more than 15% protected student enrollment, which by definition all isolated school districts do, then they receive $129 per pupil.
And Ms. Randall, is it your understanding, if we were to look at this in with today's numbers, that there would actually be additional districts that would have as many in terms of a percentage of protected students as, say, Minneapolis that are getting far less on a per pupil basis? Because wouldn't Brooklyn Center have as high a percentage?
Madam Chair, members, my understanding is that Brooklyn Center has about, I believe, 68 to 70% protected student enrollment, and I think Minneapolis is higher than that. But again, the distinction in law, the way it's done in law right now, is that it's just this 15% distinction.
Thank you.
Sure. So the isolated school districts, the adjoining school districts, and then the school districts with racially identifiable schools all receive either $92 or $129, depending on their protected student enrollment. If it's less than or equal to 15% protected student enrollment, they're in the $92 per pupil pot. If it's more than 15% protected student enrollment, they receive $129 per student. Voluntary districts, those pink districts, they receive $92 per pupil regardless of their protected student enrollment. So this is one piece of the puzzle, is the rates. The next piece is that the rate is multiplied by the total student enrollment to get to the revenue. So here is the revenue amounts for 2008. You see St. Paul received over $20 million in integration revenue, Minneapolis $18.6 or $7 million, Duluth $2.3 million in integration revenue. Here are just a couple of other districts, and you can see the range there. Anoka-Hennepin receives funding at that $129 rate, but because it's based on total pupil enrollment, they receive over $6 million in integration revenue.
Excuse me, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Randall, just to clarify, I think you made the point, but I just want to clarify that when you're talking about how these formulas are applied, they're applied against the total enrollment, not just the protected student enrollment. I see you nodding your head. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, yes, that's correct. It's against total student enrollment. And that's why you see these numbers where, you know, Anoka-Hennepin receives $6 million in integration revenue because their total student enrollment is so high. And then you can see all the way down to Round Lake, which is a really small district, receives just $12,000. And here I'll just draw your attention to Eden Prairie and Mountain Lake. Eden Prairie is a voluntary district, so one of those pink districts. So it receives $92 per pupil. Again, it's a relatively large district, so it receives over $1 million in integration revenue. Mountain Lake is a small district in southwestern Minnesota. It's one of those red isolated districts, so it has high protected student enrollment, receives funding at the higher rate, but it's very small. So it receives a total of $54,000. And so we think this, and then the next slide I'll show you too, really shows how we think the way the funding is allocated doesn't necessarily reflect the challenges that are facing each district or the responsibilities of each district. So you've got the isolated school district that maybe has more responsibility under the integration and revenue program, receiving $1 million less than a voluntary school district. So here's just another look at that, and this gets to the Brooklyn Center question. So Brooklyn Center is one of those red districts, an isolated district. This is 2005 demographics. They had about 66% of their student enrollment were protected students. And then there's Stillwater, which is a voluntary district, a pink district, had 5%. In 2005, because it's multiplied against the total student enrollment, Stillwater received almost $1 million in integration revenue, while Brooklyn Center received $250,000 in integration revenue. And if you look at it on a per protected student basis, you'll see Stillwater received $2,200 per protected student, whereas Brooklyn Center received $223 per protected student.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Randall. Just, and I'm trying to recall, and I know we had a hearing on this a couple of years ago, and so forgive me, but the racially isolated districts of Minneapolis-St. Paul and Duluth are treated uniquely from the rest of the isolated districts. Can you tell us what the history of that is or why that is so?
Madam Chair, Senator Han, well, first of all, racially isolated districts are not necessarily equivalent to Minneapolis-St. Paul and Duluth. So Minneapolis and St. Paul happen to be racially isolated districts, but so is Brooklyn Center, and so are a number of other districts that have a significant difference in their protected student enrollment from neighboring districts. So that's just the first thing I wanted to say. Secondly, it really comes down to the funding stream. You know, the way the law is written, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are identified separately in law and directly in law. Everybody else is kind of referenced more obliquely, you know, if they meet these criteria, then such and such will happen. My understanding is it's really an output of the whole history that was happening around the time when integration revenue first went into place. And I'm going to direct you to in the report on page 5. We have kind of just the major school integration events in Minnesota history, and it's kind of a quick and dirty timeline of kind of the history of different integration efforts in Minnesota. You can see in 97 the legislature established the integration revenue program. I think there was certainly thoughts at the time of there. You can see right before that in 95 there had been a lawsuit, the NAACP lawsuit. So I think there was some interest in giving those cities in particular some special attention and some special protection. I was not in the state at that time, so I can't firsthand speak to it. And I don't know if there's other folks in the room who might be able to add on to that.
And Ms. Randall, Senator Han, it was my understanding also that it was in response to the lawsuit. So when we have Mr. Brown up here, he may have, because I had asked that question too, what is that rationale? And I think it is curious. And so if we don't get that answer today, I still think it's worth doing the research to get the answer.
Madam Chair, and I might also add, I think having Mr. Gillespie here will provide some interesting input too, just because things have changed so much in this state, you know, over the last 15 years or so. So let me move now to talking about the limited oversight of the revenue. Madam Chair, this is the question you had asked previously. So the first point is that the department does not approve the integration budgets for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. All other school districts that participate in the program must submit an integration budget to the department, and the department must approve it. These three districts, again, because of the way the law is written, the department does not have authority to approve their budgets. And I'll note that those three districts collectively represent almost half of the integration revenue the state allocates. Now, interestingly, when I was updating this presentation, in 2005, they received over half of the integration revenue, and now it's almost half. This year, it's estimated to be 46% of the integration revenue. So, you know, things are definitely changing, but that's a big pot, that's a big piece of the integration revenue that's not subject to the department's oversight. The other piece is that the voluntary districts, those pink districts, they don't need the department's approval to become voluntary districts. So if Stillwater wants to work with St. Paul, Stillwater goes to, and I don't mean to pick on them, they're just, it's just for illustrative purposes. So if Stillwater wants to work with St. Paul, they approach St. Paul, hey, we'd like to work with you. You know, they develop the plan and the budget and submit that to the department, but the department doesn't have the authority to kind of first look at them and say, wait a minute, Stillwater, you know, can you contribute to the integration ideas and purposes here, and can you meaningfully participate? And perhaps the answer is yes, but there's not that authority in place. This is another piece we're updating. This was interesting. When I did this presentation in 05, there were 6 voluntary districts. Right now there's 15 voluntary districts. In 05, there was 3.4 million going to voluntary districts, and now it's a million more at 4.3 million. So this is definitely an area that has grown, and the department doesn't have this kind of extra level of authority to approve their participation. So let me go through the findings real quickly again. The purpose of the program is not clear. Districts use the revenue in a lot of different ways, mostly reasonable ways, but some questionable. And we think the funding formula has some unintended consequences. So our main recommendations here, the first one is really the big one, which is that the legislature should clarify the purpose of the program. And I think, you know, and this is, I realize, hard to wrestle with, but is this program about student achievement? You know, is it about the achievement gap? Is it about racial balance in schools? Is it about tolerance? The school district staff that we spoke with wanted clarity on this. You know, they wanted to be doing the right thing, and they wanted to do what the legislature intended, and they didn't have clarity on this. And the department staff that we worked with at the time also wanted clarity about this. I think with a sharper focus on what this program is about, A, the legislature will more likely get what it intended, and B, the legislature will also be able to tell if it's getting what it wants more easily. I mean, right now it's hard to measure if it's getting what it wants because it's not clear what's intended. Secondly, we recommend consider changing the funding formula. We have a couple of recommendations or suggestions in the report about how you might do this. One that I'll just highlight here is linking it more directly to their role within the integration revenue program. So an isolated district might receive more than an adjoining district, which might receive more than a voluntary district. So some type of gradation. There's lots of different ways to slice it, but somehow we think having the funding more directly reflect the responsibilities of a school district in this program, we think would make sense. And finally, we think the legislature should close the oversight gaps. In particular, that would mean having the Department of Education approve the integration budgets for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and also give the Department of Education the authority to approve voluntary districts, to have some kind of look at them to see if they can contribute in a meaningful way to the purpose of the program. With that, I'll end the overview. I'd be happy to answer more questions. I apologize for those technical difficulties in the beginning.
Ms. Randall, thank you very much. Sure. That I know that you've been talking about this since 2005, and so you must be concerned that your information is redundant, but it isn't redundant for our purposes, and we really appreciate it. And just let it be said for the record that the people who are testifying today are purposefully people who do not have a particular point of view about the direction we should go, that this is meant to lay the foundation for us all to then hear from many different folks who I know care quite a bit about the direction we ought to go. And so as we go forward, if you're here and you have, you know, some strong view about what we ought to do, please let my office know, and if at all possible, we'll bring you to the table. But in the beginning, I think it's important that we lay out what the rule is, what has been done, what possible ways could we move forward. So thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, I'll call Mr. Brown to the table, and if Mr. Mulcher would like to join you, he can. Okay, no. Okay. Dr. Mulcher, excuse me.
Madam Chair, Morgan Brown with the Department of Education. I'm going to try to speak relatively briefly about the department's response to the OLA's recommendations and particularly focus on those recommendations that it made to the legislature, since I know that's what this working group is and subcommittee is focusing on. If you want a more detailed version of Commissioner Segrin's response to the report, there is a letter and some attachments in the back of the OLA's report, which was the commissioner's response at the time. But in summary, and this is still our position today, the commissioner stated that she supported all eight of the recommendations that were made by the legislative auditor, and moreover, that she felt that those recommendations really should be considered or at least discussed as a package rather than kind of cherry-picking one recommendation or the other as kind of the fix, that really a lot of those recommendations were very much interconnected. I'm not going to speak as much to the recommendations to the department and what we've done since 2005, but I'm more than happy to answer questions about what steps the department has taken since those particular recommendations were made to the agency. So with regard to those recommendations that were made to the legislature, one of the things the commissioner did state is that she felt for there to be a successful effort to make some revisions or changes as appropriate to the integration revenue statute, it really was going to take a collaborative effort that would include not only the department, but also legislators and also stakeholders, because there were so many people with a lot of strong feelings, and there's a lot of history about how the DSEG rule and the integration revenue law came to be as it is currently. But certainly we have a strong interest in those recommendations that address the purpose of the statute, as Ms. Randall spoke to, that address departmental authority in several areas, and also that those that are looking at having stronger evaluation components to look at results and outcomes from integration revenue funding. In terms of this year, as you may know, the governor has actually made a proposal that a district receive any more in integration revenue than it will during this current fiscal year. So that means both districts that are currently receiving integration revenue, if they couldn't receive any more, which they might do so for a variety of reasons I'd be happy to discuss or Dr. Belcher could talk about. In addition, any districts that are currently not receiving integration revenue could not do so in the future under this proposal, at least for the near-term future. And the governor's purpose really here is to give the legislature and other stakeholders time to discuss the recommendations and decide what they want to do about the recommendations. Again, and the agency wants to be part of those conversations. But as Ms. Randall pointed out, we have seen quite a substantial increase just in the 3 years of the report, both in terms of the number of districts that are impacted by the DSEG rule and are now generating integration revenue, and also in terms of the amount of funding that is being appropriated for integration revenue. And so there was a real strong feeling we needed to get a handle on some of these recommendations at this point.
Excuse me, Mr. Brown. I have already heard that there's, you know, kind of a ripple effect from the change in the governor's budget or proposed change, and that is what about the school district that was not racially isolated until this year, and so all of a sudden has to put forward an integration plan, but we are not increasing the funding for that district. So how are we to handle that?
Right. Madam Chair, normally what would happen if we had a district that was identified as racially isolated for the first time this spring, when we see the updated enrollment numbers, they would have a year's planning time where they would begin a planning process with their adjoining districts that wanted to be part of their integration collaborative. During that planning year, there obviously isn't much programming going on, so there isn't much need, frankly, for funding during that first year. It's really after that first year when they begin implementing the programming that there's more where we see a higher demand, higher request for integration revenue when they begin submitting those annual integration revenue budgets. And obviously, I think our hope is that in the next year or so, the legislature and all parties will get together and come up with some recommendations or some changes to the integration revenue law so that perhaps there'll be a collective sense that we can move forward again with the law, but not with some of these unintended consequences that we're seeing currently.
Well, Mr. Brown, don't you think it might be wiser if we are going to put a stop towards the expansion that we temporarily suspend any naming of new racially isolated schools? If we're not going to, I think, you know, it's easy to say, well, nothing will happen for a year or so, but I think the districts that find themselves in that position are quite concerned about the ramifications of that. So I might suggest that if, in fact, the governor feels strongly about stopping and taking a step back, which I think is a wise move, that we suspend the entire naming of those schools as well.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the question. I think there's two issues. One is a procedural issue, which that would require actually amending or changing the desegregation rules. So we would have to go through, get authority from the legislature, and go through a change in terms of a rulemaking process. There probably are also some legal issues we would need to consider as well if we were actually going to suspend a district's responsibilities to look at voluntary integration planning if they met those thresholds that are currently in the DSEG rule, unless, again, we were made appropriate changes or amendments to the current rule.
Senator Han, you had stepped out of the room, and I brought up Mr. Brown talked about the governor putting a temporary stop on the expansion of the funding, and I know in particular there's a school district that has just been named a racially isolated school, and they're very concerned that they're now going to be forced to comply with the intent of the law but will not be allowed access to the funding. So that's something that we as a subcommittee ought to, even though we may not have a comprehensive bill, we ought to address that this session. Okay, thank you. Anything more?
Madam Chair, no, that's it for right now, and I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Han.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Brown, thank you for coming. I guess just to kind of follow up on Senator Bonhoff's comment here a moment ago, in terms of enforcement, and what does the district or the department do? What kinds of enforcement activities have been engaged in the last whatever period of time? And you kind of get the impression from the Office of the Legislative Auditor that there can't have been much enforcement since it was very unclear about what it is that you're to enforce. Can you just comment a little bit on the enforcement that the department has been doing?
Madam Chair, Senator Han, thank you for the question. Yes, I would say since about the 2004-2005 school year, and some of this was in response to recommendations we received from the legislative auditor, there's a number of things that we've tried to put in place in terms of closer oversight as far as our authority extends currently under the DSEG rule and the integration revenue law. And that authority is primarily in the area of reviewing the annual budgets that we're required to review and approve for all districts except for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, as was referenced earlier. I'd be happy to give you more details, but just as an example, we've, for instance, created various kinds of guidelines and rubrics and things that we use now to evaluate the integration revenue budgets and these include things like, is the budget consistent with the integration plan that the district or multiple districts have put together, and also looking at various kinds of things about how have they weighed the various expenditures, how have they prioritized various expenditures. There are some things specifically that we have authority to do within the statute, such as really integration revenue is supposed to be used to enhance existing programming. So if something looks like a supplant of programming that really should be funded by general education revenue, we certainly can raise questions about that or object to that. But generally, the guidelines are pretty broad in the DSEG rule and the integration revenue law in general. And so as long as it is consistent with the integration plan and as long as it has a purpose that's connected to expanding opportunities for interracial contact among students, it's generally acceptable. One thing we have tried to do, this isn't necessarily a requirement under the rule or the statute, but we've strongly encouraged, is for districts to explore as much as possible activities and programming which both meet the goal of voluntary integration and the goal of enhancing academic achievement and particularly closing achievement gaps. And a number of districts, to their credit, have done it, but it's something we can't mandate under our current authority.
Senator Han.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Brown, just to continue that point a little bit, has the department taken an action such as withholding funds from a budget because of the issues that you raised or questioned a plan or required a plan to be changed or any of those kinds of more demanding enforcement activities? Has anything of that nature been done by the department?
Madam Chair, Senator Han, there are numerous examples of us certainly questioning budget items, asking for additional information about budget items, and there are also examples of where we have actually not approved particular budget items that were requested in the initial budget. Now, in fairness, we do allow the district, when we deny within a certain time frame, if we deny a certain item because we don't think it meets the criteria that we've set up for the budget process, the district does have a chance to resubmit and to that money, let's say it's $20,000, and say, well, we would like to request this use for the money instead. And then we'll look at that. We don't do that on an ongoing basis, but within a limited time frame for approving the budgets. And I can get you some examples, or the subcommittee some examples of that if you would like.
Well, and
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair and Mr. Brown, perhaps for the purpose of the committee, it might be good to see the guidelines that you're using that you talked about that may give us some idea of sort of the direction that the department is taking with respect to enforcement, may help us decide what kinds of legislative direction we want to take. So it might be helpful if you could supply that to the committee.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, I'd be happy to. And there's two documents that I think you'd find very helpful. One is a frequently asked questions document we developed, I think it was in about 2005, and it's updated annually. It's really an attempt in plain language as much as possible to explain the DSEG rule and the integration revenue law and what are the criteria and guidelines for districts. The other thing that we've developed that we also use on an annual update on an annual basis, this was in response to another OLA recommendation, is a promising practices document where we show examples of districts that have done things that we think are promising, particularly in terms of meeting that dual goal of both looking at encouraging voluntary integration or opportunities for that and also increasing academic achievement. So we'd be happy to share that with you as well.
And Mr. Brown, do you have any history with regard to the significant disparity between what Minneapolis and St. Paul are getting on a per pupil basis to, say, for example, a Brooklyn Center, which has such a high percentage?
Madam Chair, I'm not an expert in this area. I will give you a brief answer, and then there are other people in the audience who've had longer history. I'm sure would be happy to testify if you want to go into more detail. Generally, my understanding is that the time that the revision of what we call the DSEG rule happened and the enactment of the integration revenue statute that was providing funding more broadly, this all happened around 99, 2000, 2001, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth were receiving programmatic funding, not on a per pupil basis, but programmatic funding for integration. And so essentially they got grandfathered in at what those amounts would be on a per pupil basis as of that time. That's my general understanding. But so it was really preserving whatever they were doing at that point.
Mr. Brown, thank you. And in terms of then picking that lower number, in terms of the
The $92 and the $129.
Yes. And having no differential between, over 50, there's no 50%.
Right.
That just has not been proposed.
I mean, the statute essentially says if you're a district with over 15% protected students, you're at the 129 level, whether you're an isolated, an adjoining, or a voluntary, and $92 if you're under that, and which is where the voluntaries would be. They'd all be at 92. But that's certainly something to review. I think in terms of one of the areas of, in terms of department authority that the OLA recommended that we would like to take a look at or have some increased authority is looking at how voluntary districts participate in collaboratives. And that's not to say there aren't some voluntary districts out there that don't do a good job and aren't sincere participants in integration collaboratives, but at a certain point you can get geographically distant enough that you wonder how useful can this very broad collaborative geographically, especially I think in some areas of rural Minnesota, in terms of meaningful interracial contact when students are spread so far apart. So that is something we'd like to look at, and we have put out at least some guidelines for collaboratives and voluntary districts to think about if they are talking about adding a voluntary district to a current integration collaborative.
And the Choice Is Yours program would be an example of a district that participates in that would then be allowed to have access to integration revenue?
The Choice Is Yours program, if you'll just allow me a minute, is a little bit of a unique situation. It was created out of a settlement between the state and the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP in a lawsuit over education adequacy. And so that was part of the settlement initially, and for 4 years it existed under the settlement, the option to have Minneapolis students who are free and reduced lunch have some preferential enrollment into suburban districts and receive state funding for the transportation to those suburban districts of their choice. When that settlement expired, the Choice Is Yours program was then adopted by the West Metro Education Program, which is the integration collaborative for Minneapolis and the western suburbs. They actually adopted that into their integration plan, and so that's how it continues to exist and continues to generate integration revenue and transportation aid for those students under that program.
Thank you. And so before we complete your testimony, Mr. Braun, would you just for the purpose of the subcommittee review what the rule is for integration aid? Do you have the written rule?
Right. For just in terms of the amounts?
The program.
For the integration revenue generally. I'm hoping I'm going to answer your question correctly, but if not, as was laid out, there are three districts that receive integration revenue at the amounts specified in statute that are higher, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. Then if you have a 15% protected student amount in your district or above, you get at the $129 per pupil level, as Ms. Randall said, for all pupils in your district. And then at the $92 per pupil amount if you're below the 15% level. And it's on the one key thing to remember, it's on a 70% state aid, 30% local levy is how that funding is raised. So it's 70% state aid, 30% raised at the local level.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yeah. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Braun, one last question. I think I just was reviewing the commissioner's response in the original report to the various recommendations that were made. The first recommendation was that the legislature should clarify the purpose of the Integration Revenue Program. That's the OLA's recommendation. And the response said that the department generally believes that there should be a portion of this that would be directed at improving student achievement or performance and closing the achievement gap. And then it says that MDE will consider drafting a legislative proposal for the legislature's consideration during the 06 session that would help implement. And I'm just wondering if the department ever was able to do that. I know it didn't say it would. It said it would consider doing it. And I just want to know what happened to the status of that if it did not get completed or what the plan might be at this point.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, all of these recommendations where we said specifics were prefaced by the introductory paragraphs that said we really felt this should be done in collaboration with legislators and the stakeholders. So it wasn't about the agency just coming out with its own plan from on high. And so it's something we've discussed with a number of stakeholders and legislators, including during this session, in terms of giving them feedback on elements we thought would be included in the plan. But we did not introduce in 2006 a plan that was just the agency's plan. And at that time, for whatever reason, there wasn't a lot of momentum around dealing with the integration revenue statute that particular year.
And just for members to know is that there really is nothing in the integration aid statute or rule that says that integration revenue ought to be towards closing the achievement gap or achieving, you know, a particular standard. And so I think those of us who have pretty much self-selected to be on this committee feel pretty strongly about that. And so we will be looking to reform the law and the policy based on certainly that commitment. I think I can speak for the members. So thank you. And I don't believe Mr. Gillespie has gotten here yet. He was testifying in the House first, and so there were a couple citizens who had requested to come forward that we honored that request. And so were you able to reach him? All right, so we'll begin with Teresa Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Were the materials handed out? I brought some materials that Mr. Eichten is going to hand out. My name is Teresa Graham. I have two licensures. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker licensed by the Minnesota Board on Social Work, and I've also been licensed as a school social worker, too, continuously since 1978. So though I'm dating myself a bit, I have an extensive career that includes 16 years of working directly in schools, both in direct service capacities and in administrative and program planning positions, as well as 14 years in working with nonprofits and as a clinical social worker. So I have a lot of experience in this area, which is why I'm here today. I don't represent a lobbying group of any kind. I hope that I represent children. And I'm probably the only person in the room that isn't being paid to be here today. but I do still feel strongly about this. I will address my comments specifically to the legislative auditor's report because Senator Bonhoff, Chair Bonhoff, asked that we not talk about our personal recommendations today. However, the members of the subcommittee have received from me a copy of a report that I, and some research that I did recently in December of 2008 and January of 2009. Specifically, that was a follow-up specifically to the legislative auditor's report. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I'm having a little trouble hearing because there's conversations going on behind me. I reviewed all 118 school district files that are kept by the Minnesota Department of Education for school districts that receive integration aid. And I compiled a spreadsheet, which I've distributed to you, on the current budget, 2009 budget, for each of those school districts, and then what the school district's plan says that they're spending the money on. I then wrote a three-page summary that's attached to that also for your review. And I won't go into all the details now, but the situation has deteriorated significantly since the 2005 legislative auditor's report, I think, in terms of how this integration revenue aid is being used. It's all over the map, everything from frivolous kinds of things to essentially patching holes in local budgets and supplanting things that should be paid for by the local school districts. I am very, very concerned that this is not going to be addressed this year. It has been brought up repeatedly since the 2005 legislative auditor's report, and perhaps it's new to some legislators, but there was extensive work done in the last couple of years by numerous individuals, both in the legislature and in community groups, on this issue. And given the state of our economy and the needs of the children of Minnesota, I really urge you to address this issue and to do something about it this year. I realize that the school districts have gotten used to having this money and don't want the money taken away from them. But it is not addressing the needs of integration, and I think it's an insult to the children of color in this state and to all the children to use this money in the way that it's being used, or rather to misuse it. I would also like to just address the comments by Commissioner Brown from the Department of Education. Having reviewed every single school district file, which I did under the Minnesota Data Practices Act, took a great deal of time, I can tell you that even intent of the legislation that's there, the rule is not being followed. There is very little evaluation in any of those files, and there's really no criteria. It does say in the rule that there's supposed to be a biannual report to the legislature from the Commissioner of Education. I saw none of those at all since this was first passed. There's supposed to be a new plan every 4 years by the school districts that receive money. It's not clear. Many of them don't exist and haven't been updated. The department rarely, if ever, denies revenue to the school districts involved. They have, in many instances, questioned the revenue, but inevitably what's happened is the superintendent of that district writes and says, here's how it's related to our plan, and then they approve it. The only exceptions I saw, I believe, were once for swimming lessons in Lakeville and for some money to go to an administrator to finish his graduate degree, sort of very blatant examples of abuse and misuse. Otherwise, it's rarely enforced. And I don't think it's a priority at all for the Minnesota Department of Education, this statute or this rule, because in the last year they haven't had a director for the program, and for a long time they only had one employee even working on it, Mr. Nwembe, who did a great job, but he's only one person. And so I urge you to really look at the history of this and the fact that a lot of work has been already done on this, and to really do something about it this year. It would be a crime not to. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. I appreciate your testimony, and I appreciate the work that you've put into this as a citizen with a commitment.
Chairperson and of the committee and committee members, my name is Roger Banks. I'm the research and policy analyst for the Council on Black Minnesotans. And I'm here because my body, my agency, and my constituencies, that I work with have a concern, or a concern, hell, a lot of concerns about the way this particular program has been operating over the years. And when the report was first issued to the Senate in 2007, we offered our assistance, i.e. the Council on Black Minnesotans, to assist the legislature in defining, getting the sharper definition of intent regarding the legislation. We also offered our assistance to Commissioner Seagram relative to setting up some kind of mechanism for the purpose of evaluating their programs in a more efficient fashion. We're concerned essentially because this program has been in operation for a large number of a few years, and we're concerned that if you look at the issue of evaluation, that very little has been done. This organization, this program, has had three statewide conferences, none of which addressed any of the issues raised in the audit report. You have a whole range of conditions that should be addressed and reviewed, one of which has to do with the direction of funding for this particular program. It's our feeling that it's not solely the school districts who have a role to play in this whole process. There are populations out in the community, particularly parents and boards of education, that have taken action that in many respects acerbates the problem of integration. They have in fact made policy decisions that have caused greater segregation than integration. And I'm speaking primarily of the attendance policies that were developed by the school district for Osseo and for Bloomington. Okay? And so what I'm concerned about is that there needs to be a real, honest, and concerted effort to try to resolve some of the problems facing this program. From the onset, we've always felt that it was a good idea to promote these kinds of values and philosophies. But unfortunately, the direction that it has taken has been directionless. And one of the principal reasons, and it was pointed out in the legislative audit report, was that the legislature did not provide sufficient direction, okay, and that the school Department of Education has not provided the kind of fiduciary monitoring that's absolutely necessary. We recommended, for example, that in the area of evaluation, that the program adopt a two-tiered evaluation process. By that we mean that there are statewide goals that should be assessed to determine the extent to which they've been achieved. And then there are programmatic goals, that is the impact of the program on the clients and the individuals who are involved in this whole process should be part of that evaluation process. Right now, very little has been done in terms of evaluation, and most of it has been programmatic. And so the state really doesn't have any kind of direction relative to the extent to which state goals, i.e. the objectives of the program, have been achieved. And
well,
so, yeah.
Mr. Banks, I think that we have identified that as an issue,
yeah,
and that
right.
We do appreciate your comments and concur with that sentiment, and that's why we are meeting. And so I hope that you will find, as this process goes forward, that the legislature is choosing to provide leadership and direction, and we look forward to having you work with us as we embark on that.
Very much so. You can count on that. That's
thank you very much.
The principal focus of my organization. And thank you very much for this.
Well, thank you for being a resource and providing that testimony here today. Thank you. And Ms. Graham, thank you for providing such extensive background in terms of the packet you've provided as well.
Thank you.
And now we do have Mr. Gillespie has joined us, and so we look forward to hearing his testimony. And Mr. Gillespie, we have let the public know and the committee know that we think that the changes in our demographics going forward are a critical element that we should be considering as we review this overall policy. And so your testimony today will be at the heart of how we look at things.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Department of Administration. Thank you for inviting me here, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. You should have a handout that I just passed over the rail, and thank you for your forbearance. I was at another committee hearing. It's a competitive time. The population of Minnesota is changing rapidly in some respects, and one respect is that we are becoming a more racially and ethnically diverse population. That said, Minnesota is right now one of the least diverse states in the country, but we are changing very rapidly. So between the 2000 census in 2007, according to estimates by the U.S. Census Bureau, the Minnesota's total population increased by a little over 5%, 5.3%, while the Latino population increased by approximately 42%, the Black or African American by nearly 28%, the Asian population by more than 23%, and the American Indian population by more than 7%. The population of two or more races is also increasing rapidly, having increased by more than 25%. The sources of the change are largely migration and immigration, migration from other states as well as immigration from other countries, coupled with a relatively high rate of natural increase. The difference between births and deaths, to a large extent, that is due to a younger, much younger age population. The people who move long distances and cross significant boundaries tend to be a young population. It's young people that do these things. Older people tend to be much less likely to move long distances. And so as a result of the migration and immigration, we have a rapidly growing, relatively younger population. And that's reflected also in the higher birth rates, which further increases the youthful age of our populations of color in Minnesota. As a result of this, the fact that the minority populations are substantially younger, it also means that our schools are more likely to see large-scale changes than our middle-aged and older populations. The population under age 18 in Minnesota is now approximately 22% minority, compared to the 18 and over population of approximately 12% minority population. Our schools since 2000, and these are the numbers for the 1999 to 2000 school year to the 2008-2009 school year that we are in right now. Enrollments among Asian students, Hispanic or Latino, and Black or African American students have increased sharply. We've also seen some increase in the American Indian school enrollment, but the majority white school enrollments have declined, and as a result of the large decline in the majority white students, we see an overall modest decline in the overall enrollments. But this is a reflection that our student bodies are changing, and we are changing fairly rapidly in our public schools.
Mr. Gillespie, I think I might have asked you this the last time I looked at this, and I still have this question about if we were to include the private school population, what would these numbers look like?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they would change a bit. The estimates from the I haven't factored in the these numbers, because these are sort of hot off the press, the latest numbers out of the Department of Education that were just recently released. Most of the students in private schools in Minnesota, that based upon survey data, most of the students are majority white students, and so that would lower the numbers a bit. We haven't seen huge trends either in enrollments or in racial composition of private schools since the beginning of this decade. So it would not substantially change this, though there would be some modification in the number.
Mr. Gillespie, so for the one I'm looking at is the 85,450 white students less. Do you have any sense of what that number might be if we included the private school students in that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have looked at this in the past, and I'm trying to remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it's been nearly a year since I've looked at that. But that would change that a bit, but it would not be a substantial change to modify the basic conclusion that that we are seeing a decline in overall enrollments, and that is not being countered by large-scale increases in the private school enrollments.
Thank you. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillespie, I think that the Chair's question is such a good one, and I would like us to follow up on it because I think it is an important factor. We oftentimes make analysis of data in education based on total population, and we're confused as to, you know, this 85,000 is a big number, and I was wondering exactly the same thing that you're wondering, Senator Bonhoeff, in terms of what proportion of this white population is actually going to private schools. And I understand that there is also a trend with children of color in certain districts. So there is a decline of enrollment in public schools for children of color in some districts that I would like to see kind of this pattern of certain populations going to private schools. And I think that would be an interesting analysis for us.
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I'll be more than happy to pull together that information and submit that to you this week.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you.
The largest scale changes that we are seeing are particularly in the suburban ring around the Twin Cities, as well as some of the rural school districts in Minnesota. This is not entirely an urban change that we are seeing large changes in selected districts. Districts such as Worthington and St. James and a number of other similar school districts have reported large-scale changes. At this time, the inner ring suburbs outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul, but in some of the inner ring suburbs, are also experiencing rapid change in their enrollments. And enrollments of students of color as well as students that speak languages other than English at home. If we look forward into over the next couple decades, between now and approximately 2020, the largest scale increases that we are expecting are in the Latino population, nearly doubling in population by 2020, with additional large proportional increases in the Asian population over 64%, and the Black or African American population over 63%, and again, rapid change in the population of two or more races, more than 56%. The American Indian population is also projected to grow faster than the total population at about 15%. And so we will continue to be an increasingly racially diverse population. Minnesota today has approximately 14% of our population is minority population, either populations of color or Latino. That is compared with nearly 33% nationally. We are substantially less diverse than the nation. Over the next 25 years, we will continue to be increasingly diverse, but we will not catch the nation up during that period. At this time, according to Census Bureau estimates, our two most diverse counties, Hennepin and Ramsey counties, are less diverse than the national average. Ramsey is racially and ethnically the most diverse county in Minnesota, and we are projecting that by 2020, Ramsey County will catch the nation up in diversity, but not be substantially more diverse than the nation. Hennepin County will continue to see increases, but by 2035 will still be a bit below the national average, and we're projecting continued increases both in the Twin Cities and throughout the state in populations of color and become increasingly diverse over that time.
Mr. Gillespie, excuse me. You're now talking about total population versus children, correct?
Madam Chair, yes.
And so do you have any information with regard to if we are lagging the nation if we were looking at children?
Madam Chair, at this time we are lagging the nation in the percent of minority children, yes.
And Mr. Gillespie, do you project as we look forward that will also be the case?
Madam Chair, we did not do, we have not done a projection by age, and race and ethnicity. My assumption is that we would continue to be less diverse than the nation going forward into the future.
Mr. Gillespie, one of the questions I would have, and not even so much as compared to the nation, but if we could, when we look at our projections of diverse population, if we could look at it in the next short amount of time, 5 years, 10, just looking at the children. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Continue.
And with that, I can stand for questions or.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
excuse me. Thank you. I'm just trying to. A little bit of calculation here. I don't know if I was able to get it done, but the growth in minority populations in Minnesota, the rate of increase that you described, is that faster rate of increase than other states, slower than other states? Is it
on average?
Look at the United States as a whole, because you've got pretty wide variation in terms of state population diversity. Can you comment at all about how Minnesota might compare?
Senator Hand, Madam Chair, Senator Hand, I do not have the numbers in front of me, but for some of the largest states with that are the most diverse populations, have such large numbers that proportionally they will grow at a smaller rate, but numerically at a much faster rate than Minnesota. We are so different from the rest of the country right now, so much less diverse than the rest of the country, that our growth rates and growth rates of states similar to us will be very rapid for the next couple decades as we see increases in population and increase that base.
Senator Hand.
Chair and Mr. You know,
part of me wants to say
that's not a bad thing, that we see a rapid increase in growth of different populations in Minnesota. The context that we're talking about this is sort of presumptively negative, that this is presents a problem or a challenge. And I just wanted to maybe, do you want to comment at all about that? Do we presume that if we see large growth in minority populations that is a de facto issue in terms of education or achievement or other things? Or
Mr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, I would not put a value judgment on that. There are some issues of differences in educational achievement that that I think that there's been quite a few comments made about, and some concern about what the long run implications are. But the growth in population is large, particularly of younger people, is largely related to a growth of jobs and a growth of economic growth that people are responding to. The general tendency is as the people who move from Minnesota tend to resemble the average Minnesotan, and the people that move to Minnesota from other states resembles the average American, and that is a substantially different population. We're not the focus of the change. We're merely beginning to change as the nation has long been changing.
And Senator Hahn, I would say that I agree with your raising the question, because I think the diversity is a wonderful thing, as long as we develop policies and practices in our state that provide a framework for making certain that the citizens of Minnesota have the tools to achieve the kind of life that they've come here to achieve. And so I think that is part of our challenge. You know, we know that we're going to have a workforce shortage in 10 years and 15 years, and so isn't our best opportunity the fact that these children are choosing to, or their parents are choosing to raise them in Minnesota? And so if we get our job done here, then this changing demographic will be very positive for the state of Minnesota, and I think it already is, but I think that we can see that there are stressors on the way that we currently provide education, because we have not been dealing with the kinds of diversity in Minnesota that other states have been dealing with for a long time. And I think that may go towards why we have one of the highest achievement gaps when it comes to children of color, because it didn't reflect the way that our state had gone in the past. We haven't perhaps taken the necessary measures to make sure that each and every child is succeeding. And so that's why I'm so thankful that you're here and to present your testimony. And I think, you know, the questions with regard to the children are just because that is our charge, and so we need to do our job. But thank you very much. Any other comments for Mr. Gillespie? I know there are some people in the audience who have asked to testify, but either the senators, any other comments? Thank you very much for being there today.
Thank you.
Apparently, there are some of the school districts that just wanted to come forward. Dan Jett, who is the superintendent of the West Metro Education Program. There are some challenges that we all know right now, or I don't know if everybody knows, but right now there are some issues with regard to WEMAP, and so if you might comment on that as well.
Actually, Madam Chair, if I might, could I invite the other representatives from the other two metro integration districts, and we could as a panel?
Certainly.
Perhaps
thank
do that.
You.
Thank you. I appreciate it. While we may, Madam
Chair.
Just
state your name for the record, please.
I'm sorry. I'm Dr. Daniel Jett, superintendent of the West Metro Education Program. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I hope we have a chance to visit with you again down the road. I have so much I'd like to say, but I know today's not the day, so I'll be selective in my comments. The West Metro Education Program is comprised of 11 member districts, Minneapolis and the 10 western suburban districts, starting in the north with St. Anthony, Columbia Heights, Brooklyn Center, and working your way around to Richfield. In addition, we have two voluntary districts, Eden Prairie, as well as Wayzata. In terms of the legislative auditor's report, which was the original topic this afternoon, we have reviewed that report and generally are in concurrence with the findings and with the recommendations. We would very much appreciate a clear purpose and focus for the program, and we commit to you that with that, we will program all of our efforts and initiatives to accomplishing those goals. With that said, I would like to, and this I'm speaking on my own behalf as well as my districts, and I think the others agree, but I won't speak for them. We think that perhaps the primary shift that may need to occur is in that of having the Minnesota legislature take having integrated schools that are equitable as a state interest, as something that you want to have happen, and that you purposely adopt legislation to achieve, and that you then fund in order to have that outcome. I use the term equity to mean that all students learn at high levels with there being no disparities between various groups within the student body. So all students performing high with no gaps in between. Right now, member districts, or districts, we call them member districts, can work together or not. But I don't see in the current rule a state's imperative to have integrated schools. And I think if you started there, you would then create measures and outcomes that would tell you you have integrated schools that are being successful, and then you could put your resources behind those initiatives and measure perhaps far more easily your outcomes. What's not been mentioned so far in terms of integration, use of integration revenue and activities, are magnet schools that are operated by these three integration districts. It was alluded to how the Northwest Suburban District operates, and I'll let their superintendent, Marsha Moore Foster, in a minute explain further and respond to questions. WEMEP and EMID, which is the East Metro Integration District, we each operate two magnet schools. There are two in WEMEP. One is called FAIR, Fine Arts Interdisciplinary Resource School, opened in 2000, one of the award-winning top six magnet schools in the country. I'll tell you more about that if you ask. We're very proud of it. We work very hard on eliminating the racial achievement gap there, and we actually are showing success. We have students from all 11 districts come to that school every single day. Our member districts, by the way, at one time represented over 100,000 students. With declining enrollment, it's not quite. But you can
excuse
see,
me, Dr. Jett, what is the racial diversity at FAIR?
FAIR is currently 65% white and 35% non-white.
And Dr. Jett, what is the racial diversity? Do you know of that area?
Well, the school is located in Crystal, so that area would be Robbinsdale. And I don't have those figures with me, but that is one of our challenges as an organization, is to attempt to identify what would be, if you will, the right mix. Is it 65-35? Is it 60-40? What is that percentage? And we're, as an organization, trying to figure that out and then to develop policies that will help us reach that. Keep in mind, though, we're a voluntary district, and so all of our enrollment comes because families make choices to join us. So it's a matter of our making incentives for various families to join us. Our second school is the Interdistrict Downtown School, located at 10th and Hennepin Avenues. When you turn off at 12th Street, it's the big red building right up on the right. We have struggled a bit with the downtown school. It opened 2 years before FAIR. However, we, after a year and a half or so of hard work with our board and our parents supporting us, we have rethemed the downtown school as an arts magnet, and we intend to pair it with FAIR going forward.
And Dr. Jett, what is the racial diversity of that
school? The racial diversity there is approximately 70% non-white and 30% white.
Thank you.
We do, and I'll finish with this, Madam Chair and members. We do believe that organizations such as ours, regional organizations, can indeed play a constructive role as you move forward. We think it does not have to be housed in St. Paul at the Department of Roseville in the Department of Education. And so we stand ready to provide that support as you move forward and to engage in the conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I have toured both your schools and am impressed with both of them. Thank you.
They are impressive. Thank you.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Jett, I apologize, but I don't know how long you've been superintendent, but you've made the comment in your introductory remarks about that you agreed with the recommendation of the OLA that the purpose of the program was a little unclear, but the WEMEP program has been in place for some time, and so as an organization, you must have some purpose. And I'm wondering if you could, even if the purpose in law and the statutes are not clear, what has been the purpose that your organization has directed its efforts toward, and how would you gauge its success at this point?
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, when I've been there since 2004. WEMAP goes back to the early 90s, late 80s. It was an organization called CIIP, which is a cooperative integration, I don't remember, but it really is a long history, and it was voluntary, and there was no DSEG rule around, there was no money around. Minneapolis and its suburban counterparts, leaders, superintendents, were recognizing the change in demographics coming forward and wanted to work together voluntarily to train staff and successfully deal with the changes that were taking place. That said, the mission of our organization in part until 2006 basically said that we were to provide opportunities for staff and students from different backgrounds to learn from and with each other. And that's almost a quote. It's at least a paraphrase. So for that mission, we have magnet schools that bring students in from 11 districts. Arguably, that's successful. We have staff who come from all of our member districts. We train about 1,700 staff members a year from the various districts in cultural competence types of activities and so forth. I have a more complete summary of those activities I'd be happy to provide. In 2006, our board, and we are governed by a 22-member board. It is the superintendent and an elected board member from each of our districts. So it's 22 members, 11 members, two from each. We changed our mission to be more specific and deal with the racial achievement gap and racial disparities. So for us, it's a little over a two-year journey of going from what might be called the softer side of providing opportunities for students and staff from different backgrounds to learn from and with each other to focusing on eliminating an achievement gap by race and a participation gap and so forth that goes with it. On that, we are beginning to see success, particularly at our Fair School that I alluded to earlier, and we are hopefully positioning ourselves to become model schools so that others can learn from us in that regard.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Bonhoff, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Griebel. I'm the Director of Education Services for the East Metro Integration District. And EMID, similar to WEMAP, does support, for the most part, the recommendations from the OLA report. In particular, we really support having the legislature provide some clarity around the purpose of the rule. And like many have said already, we do also support a balance between supporting academic achievement and closing the achievement gap, as well as continuing to provide those opportunities for interracial student contact. Those two together, that balance, I think, is what is has been missing. So we definitely do support that. I would like to address one of the recommendations was around the funding formula, and there's been a lot of conversation about that maybe there are some unintended consequences of the current funding formula. EMID would maintain that the funding formula is meant to benefit all students. Earlier, Tom Gillespie talked about the changing face of Minnesota and how we are becoming more diverse, and that at EMID we truly believe that integration is meant to benefit white students as well as students of color, that to really provide meaningful opportunities, students, all students, have to benefit from that integration. And so therefore the funding formula needs to make sure that it does link to that. So we do support support funding on total pupil units. So we do recognize that every district maybe has a different situation. The current formula provides for differing levels of support depending on the situation, whether you are a racially isolated district, an adjoining district, or a voluntary district. So we think there is some differentiation. We would support examining that, but we do believe that it should be funded based on all pupil units because all students should be benefiting from the integration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And excuse me, Ms. Is it Griebel?
Griebel, that's
Griebel.
Correct.
Do you have magnet districts or magnet schools also, and how
yes,
many?
Yes, Chair Bonhoff. We have two magnet schools. One is a K-5 elementary school located in Maplewood, and then we have a 6 through 10 program serving students in grades 6 through 10 in Woodbury. And currently the enrollment at those two schools is about 50% from St. Paul, which is our racially isolated district, and 50% from our surrounding suburban districts. And the enrollment at both schools right now is at 50% students of color, 50% white students.
Thank you. Senator Hand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Griebel, could you respond to the similar question that I asked Dr. Jett? Just, I'm not sure how long EMID has been in place or how long you've been there, but again, even if there's a lack of clarity in the statute about what the purpose of this program is, obviously, as long as the organization has been in place, they've had some kind of purpose. And could you comment about what that is and how successful you've been on achieving or moving toward that achievement?
So, Chair Bonhoff, Senator Hahn, thank you for the question. EMID has been in existence since 1999. And in about 2004, we revised our strategic plan to provide more balance. We have goals around student achievement, racial integration, and then as an integration collaborative, we feel that providing leadership for our member districts is another important role that we play as an integration collaborative. And so to that end, all of our student programs, all of our programs for staff, really address both academic and cultural components and provide opportunities for students to come together and learn together again, because we believe that integration is really meant to benefit all students. So we have developed, as I said, all of our programs and services, whether it's the magnet schools, our after-school programs, our professional development. Really, we try and marry those two concepts of student achievement and providing opportunities for interracial student contact. I don't know.
Thank you, Ms. Griebel. If you have a written document with your statement of purpose,
absolutely,
and the same for you, Dr. Jett, if you could submit it to us just for our reference, that would be great. And same with you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Moore?
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marcia Moore. I'm superintendent of Northwest Suburban Integration School District. I'd like to start out by saying that we're the baby of the three. We were formed in 2001. We have seven districts. Our districts are Fridley, Brooklyn Center, Osseo, Anoka-Hennepin, Buffalo, Elk River, and Rockford. And as you can tell, geographically, we go from urban to suburban to rural. We took a different approach from our counterparts in that Northwest does not operate schools. We actually have opened up 15 magnet schools in our seven districts. The schools themselves, the districts themselves, actually operate the schools. We provide funding, professional development, supplemental type services. We were able to do this by actually applying for and receiving $24 million in federal grant money. That money was used to build capacity, to buy materials, curriculum, and so forth. We also used some of our local, what we term local dollars, to also help start the schools. We've been successful in moving kids across boundaries, districts. Right now, I don't want to give you a hard number yet, but it's about 3,000 that we're moving across districts. And then of the 15 schools themselves, we have between 10,000 and 15,000 students that are participating in magnet schools. The other programs we have were based on what we felt our interpretation of the rule was. We were formed, about 150 community members came together and sat down and formed focus groups to say what direction they wanted the district to go to and their interpretation of the rule. We interpreted as providing intentional opportunities for interracial opportunities and also offering programs that are educationally justifiable. For example, we have a program called AVID. It's such a weird investment via individual determination, AVID. That's a program that shoots for students who are like at the D grade average, C average, who are just kind of falling through the cracks, and then they are prepared for post-secondary education by being encouraged to take AP courses with tutors and so forth. Or another program we do is a Future Educators Club. It's an extracurricular opportunity for students as we try and recruit and encourage students to go into teaching. All of these different programs, we take advantage of them to bring opportunities to bring them together also for interracial opportunities, interaction. In speaking with my seven superintendents, we have some key messages. One is to define the purpose of the rule. My seven superintendents feel that it should do both, like my counterparts are saying, both provide opportunities for integration activity, and second is to work on student achievement to close the achievement gap. We're also looking at ways to work collaboratively with the other metro districts in providing some services. We tend to do a lot of the programs. Some of these guys are stronger in areas than we are, so we're exploring ways to work together. We're all very conscious of the economic environment now and looking for ways to work together. We also support the recommendations for the legislative audit report, such as been stated earlier. Thank you.
Thank you. And when you raised, Ms. Moore, when you raised your funding issue, it raised the question for me. I don't know if the other members know this, but Dr. Jett and Ms. Griebel, the funding that you receive in these two schools, does that go directly to WEMAP and the East Metro Integration District, or does that come through the member districts? Could you just say where your funding comes from?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. The school buildings themselves were built by the state of Minnesota, all four of them, the two that we have as well as the two in East Metro. The funding for the pupils, the students who attend the schools, is passed along by member districts in the form of what we would call tuition. It is payment to us on a per pupil basis in the same quantity as if the student had remained in their district, which means our member districts make a considerable sacrifice because they also send all of their levy dollars. So not only is it basic state aid, but it is levy as well. The theory back when schools started was they wanted to support all of their students with the same financial, at the same financial level, whether they attended school in their schools or the magnet schools, which in our bylaws they termed their schools. In other words, the idea was to simply have a district have its list of schools plus two more, because they were very much a part of what we were doing. So that's how we're funded now. In the past and current year, we do receive about, in our case, $600,000 of integration revenue through our member districts on a voluntary pass-through basis to support our schools. However, going forward into next year, our board has decided that the schools should operate on their tuition revenue only, because member districts have integration needs back home, if you will, and they will keep that revenue back home.
So, Dr. Jett, the $600,000 of integration revenue, is that apportioned on a per pupil basis? The member districts are figuring out what each kid would actually get based on what they get as a total member district, and then they're allowing that to come with the student just like the other parts of the formula come with the student?
Madam Chair, not exactly. Our overall budget, which is about $13 million, including schools, training, everything on an annualized basis, is about the integration revenue portion of that is about $2 million. And we kind of back into a number for each member district. We develop our program of courses and training that our members want us to offer. We cost it out. We run a summer school for 900 students. We cost it out. We take what we've needed at the schools and cost it out, and that gives us that lump sum figure, let's say $2 million. And then we take the member district total enrollment in the aggregate, divide it into that amount, and get a per pupil amount. This year, it's $28 per pupil. So if our member districts are all receiving, most of them get $129, they're sending $28 to WEMAP for WEMAP programming, including that small portion that goes for the magnet schools. Did that answer that question?
Dr. Jett, and it looks like Senator Hand might have a follow-up, but okay. Where did you come up with In your total budget, what had you come up with that $2 million of it was integration-related?
We take the programs and services that we offer that are not related to our schools. And I'll give you an example. Summer school is about, I'm going to estimate, about $90,000. Working with the National Urban Alliance with X number of teachers and 39 school sites has a cost. Working with the Pacific Education Group has a cost. Administrative overhead has a cost. And so when you aggregate those, that's how you get to the $2 million. Historically, that number has changed. Matter of fact, 2 years ago, districts were sending us $46 per pupil because they wanted us to be offer a more robust program within UA, National Urban Alliance. Since then, they've brought that down some because they're trying to provide the training in-house instead of continuing to buy it. And so the number is an annual number that moves based on programming.
And, Dr. Jett, the recent change that Minneapolis is considering is to pull out altogether or just to stop allowing the pass-through dollars to flow through?
Well, my understanding, Madam Chair, is that the proposal was to withdraw membership. And then subsequent to that announcement, my understanding was that Superintendent Green was amenable to having students from Minneapolis who currently attend our magnet schools and who may wish to in the future continue to do so, but it would be under some arrangement yet to be negotiated with WEMAP. So I don't know whether he was thinking basic state aid or current practice or what the case may be. However, Minneapolis does not send any of its integration aid to WEMAP. There is a long-standing historical practice that Minneapolis does not send any, they don't send the $28 per pupil. The integration aid that they receive, Minneapolis keeps. They do send us, however, in all fairness, tuition for all the students they send us, and they send us between 40 and 45% of our students. So it's not insignificant, but it's not integration aid.
Ms. Griebel.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out just a few of the differences between how WEMAP is funded and how they operate and EMID, just a few slight differences. Like WEMAP, we also receive tuition revenue for the students that attend our schools, and it does come to us from the member districts. We do not, however, include the excess levy in that amount. So we that is not part of the formula, the tuition formula. And then for membership, all of our suburban districts, not St. Paul, but our suburban districts send us $52 of their original allocation, whether it's 92 or 129. They send to EMID $52 per pupil unit to then support the magnet schools as well as the integration programs and services that we provide. So there are a few differences in how those are funded.
Ms. Griebel, so they send you $52 of just the number of students that you're serving or of all of the students
of all in their
of the districts?
Students in their districts. And then we provide services so they don't have to necessarily come up with those programs, develop those programs locally. We'll work with our member districts to identify whether it's summer programs, whether it's student programs, professional development. We will provide those for the collaborative so that they do retain some of their funding for local initiatives and working directly with St. Paul, and then they forward to us $52. Now, again, St. Paul is treated a little bit differently. They do not forward to us that $52, but again, they do support 50% of the enrollment at the two schools. And for the students that attend the schools, we do receive St. Paul's full $445 of integration revenue for those students that come to the schools.
Mm. So Ms. Griebel, so you get the tuition, as which would be the formula.
The general formula, correct.
Yep, exactly. In addition to, on a per pupil basis, in addition to that allowance.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So they're very different funding models, and actually all three are very different mm-hmm. funding models. And before I call on you, Ms. Mm-hmm. Moore, do you submit your budget to the Department of Education on an annual basis for approval?
Madam Chair, yes. We are similar to all of the other districts. We are required to submit an annual budget for approval, and then we submit a plan every 4 years. And so our budget, our annual budget, needs to align with that integration plan. And that integration plan was developed in collaboration with our members.
Thank you. Ms. Moore?
Our funding. Now I'm going to really confuse you again. I just want to clarify the $24 million that I spoke about earlier, that was a federal grant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Our funding works where each of our district keeps their levy dollars in their district. They give us a percentage of their integration aid, and it's based on whether the district is declared racially isolated or if they have over 15% students of color. For example, Brooklyn Center keeps 81% in their district, and they give the remaining amount to Northwest for operation. Osseo does the same thing. Anoka and Fridley keep 68% in their district, and then we get the balance. And the other ones that are just more member districts that keep 51%, and we get the balance. So our formula is a little bit simpler, not quite as complicated.
And Ms. Moore, you submit your budget.
We do, and a four-year plan.
Thank you. Well, you know, we did not put the three of you on the agenda, and actually that was an oversight on my part, because I can see that you, us understanding this particular piece of the overall structure is critical, and so I appreciate that you just educated us today, and I'm sure as time goes on you'll want to give us more opinions and suggestions for direction, but I appreciate that today you provided us with this overview. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe just as a general comment, if these three districts would care to submit to our subcommittee a little summary of the things you just went over with us in terms of the financing differences and your statements about your purpose and mission that you've all described, and I think those things might be very helpful for us. I did have a question, maybe that any of you or all of you, if you care to respond to that, but. In all three of your missions, you kind of are recognizing that there's an achievement piece that you're interested in, and then there's also describing it different ways. But I think, Ms. Moore, you talked about it as intentional opportunities for interracial interaction, but things of that sort. And my question is, how do you measure those kinds of, you know, we wrestle enough with measuring student achievement here, and so I'm curious to know if you can't answer it today, maybe you could write us a little note about it, but how do you measure that? How do you know you're doing that? And I guess related to that, how would you compare the performance of your districts and the schools that you may operate in comparison to other school districts that may not be participating? In other words, there probably are other districts that might conceivably be qualify for a voluntary or even a, I don't know if they can, I don't know, I guess, but it's conceivable there may be other districts out there. And so how is what you're doing compare in terms of improvement on these dimensions to those other districts? Or maybe that's nothing that people have looked at yet, but if you have any comment on that now, or if you'd like to write us something to talk about it, I'd be curious to know. I think it might be helpful for our committee.
Senator Bonham and Senator Hahn, I'd like to defer answering that today only because we are not active in that arena right now, but I think we should be. And so I'd be eager to have some dialogue about what would some of those measures look like. And of course, when you measure, when one measures anything other than academic achievement, sometimes you're measuring a proxy. For example, if we train most or all of the teachers in the suburban areas and have them become culturally competent, by some measure they're culturally competent, we would take that as a proxy for therefore students are achieving better. And so I think that can be helpful, but the rubber meets the road, so to speak, at the end of the day in terms of that student achievement and having our communities be successful for all who reside in them. And that's the ultimate measure, is how are we doing? You alluded, some of you alluded earlier, I think, Madam Chair, you alluded earlier to the fact that Minnesota has this large gap, if not the largest, certainly among the largest, and the conversation tends not to get to that. Up front, we get to our ACT scores, which we ought to be thrilled with and proud of, but there are some other measures that we need to really keep front and center because, again, to repeat myself, I really think it's in the state's interest. And I think having the legislature put a stake down that it is in your interest is what I would encourage.
Go ahead.
We have done Madam Chair, Committee, we have done evaluations of our district since 2001. They're more formative evaluations that have helped us guide our program implementation and development. Because of a federal grant, we do have hard data for our magnet schools that we would be more than happy to share with you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Ms. Senator Hahn, EMID, we are taking baby steps in this evaluation arena, especially around the interracial student contact piece, because it is something that is not as tangible. It's harder to get your head around. Are you just talking about counting the number of students that move back and forth, or is it something a little more meaningful than that? And so we are currently conducting an impact study of students that are participating in our classroom partnerships to see what impact is this having on the students who are having these meaningful interracial opportunities to both explore academics and culture. Are we seeing an impact on that? And so we're really looking forward to seeing the results of that, which should be ready this summer.
Thank you. Dr. Jett.
Madam Chair, if I could, one more comment. And Senator Hahn, I got on that point. I felt strongly about it. And I wanted to come back to the point you mentioned about comparing to other schools and evaluations. We do evaluate our work. You know, Choice is Yours is one of our programs. And in partnership with the state, we have an annual evaluation of the Choice is Yours. It's done by Aspen Associates. And I'll be happy to forward the most recent summary to you. And if you'd like more, we'll send you the whole thing. We also have had Aspen Associates do evaluation of our magnet schools. And also, within our evaluation, we have found that the training we do with teachers and principals in our member districts seems to be paying off, because the Minneapolis students who go to the suburbs under Choice is Yours, they and their families report over a 3 or 4 year period that suburban teachers and schools are better prepared now to meet their needs and to address their concerns. And the data we have about student participation in school activities in the suburbs as compared to when they were in the city, their parent participation in PTA and those kinds of things, we have those data. Again, they're proxies, but they're good data to have that gives you confidence that we're going in the right direction. We also have, at our magnet schools, we have done comparisons, and I don't have comparisons with schools who might be like us but who aren't involved with it, but we do compare to our member districts, and we compare quite favorably, particularly at our Fair school. And I don't want to leave out IDDS, but it's more dramatic, the results we've had at Fair so far. And the performance there is just outstanding. And it's because of the intentionality of the staff, because the leadership of the principal, and because our focus on talking about, not only talking about, but having race become a very important part of the education of children from grades 4 through grade 8. It's a very natural conversation for them and their families, and we believe it really pays off. Thank you.
And Dr. Jett, and actually all of you, any documented data that you'd like to share with the committee would be very helpful. Senator Phoebe?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the reports, all three of you. Just in addition to some of the information that Senator Hahn asked for, total student populations, number of students served, and your total general operating budget.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, that completes the first. I'm sorry, Senator Torres-Ray. Senator Torres-Ray, when we introduced ourselves, you weren't here. I talked about you, but if you'd let anything you'd like to add, please feel free. Yes, good things.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Bonoff. Yes, my name is Patricia Torres-Ray, and I represent District 62. which includes the Minneapolis School District. Senator Bonhoff, what I wanted to say, I know you have a committee here in a few minutes, so a lot of people are going to start coming in, but I think what, as you know, I'm very passionate about this issue, and I intend to work with the committee and with you for as long as it takes so that we can do this the right way. But what we have learned, and I think you've learned more than anybody else, is that change is tough. And every time we propose something, then our districts come to say, oh, that's not the right way. It really doesn't matter. I'm just telling you ahead of time, no matter what we do here, you're going to come to tell us, oh, that's the wrong way. I already predict that. And so I think that what I would like to recommend, Madam Chair, that we do is that we take our time and that we do this publicly and that to the extent that we can, we receive from you the information and analyze the information. I am so thankful to Ms. Graham who brought this report that she did because I think, and she worked on this just, you know, with her own methodology, and I think that I would like to have something very similar to this produced by the department that tells us, you know, what are the districts actually doing with this money. It's interesting in my own district, which receives a chunk of the money. I don't even have but just two sentences in here, and I'd like to know more. And I think that will be important for us. And the other issue, too, Madam Chair, that is concerning to me is that, and this is just my personal frustration, is that I hope we move away from talking about formulas and talk about children, because this presents a tremendous opportunity for us to really talk about, you know, what is really happening to these children. And for the districts, I think what they need to know is that maybe we will completely redesign this formula. And then they need to start thinking about, really, that they might not have this money because we might change this thing entirely, depending on what we find. And that you should be prepared for, because that may be coming. We really need to look at academic outcomes for children of color. As a person of color who has worked on this for years, but more concretely for 3 years in the Senate, when I see the formulas and I see that a lot of the funding formulas that we put in place are supposed to follow a low-income child that is black or Latino, that live in low-income housing, that has transportation problems, behavioral problems, and I see that we put a lot of funding into these groups, but the academic outcomes for these groups are the worst in the state of Minnesota, I have a problem with that. And I think that we need to change that, and I am going to be a strong voice for the rest of my time in the Senate, and I think this is a formula that I would like us to review very carefully, Madam Chair, and see if we could make a difference. It's only 80 something million, but it's an opportunity, and I think we should take advantage of it.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, and I think you weren't present when we, in the introduction, did state that we were going to move very slowly and that I would be shocked if we had something this session, because this is a complex issue and a lot of children are counting on us. And so I couldn't agree with you more, and I think you'll find that all of us feel the same way. And it is going to be a tough subject to tackle because the way the funding has been set out, we understand these are tough times and everybody is, you know, needs every penny they have. And so when you start to unravel some of the funding elements of the discussion, that gets dicey. So, thank you. Anybody else? Well, with that, the subcommittee is adjourned.